Dealing with Sexual Desire and Infatuation. The first talk in a series titled Sodom and Sexual Purity was presented by Jack Crabtree on January 7, 2003, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
As I understand our purpose tonight, it will be to be a little bit more general. As
the quarter goes on, we will deal with more specific issues concerning our culture and sexuality in our culture today. But I'm going to, Nancy and Larry and I are going to deal with just sort of the more general question of, in general, how do we deal with sexual desire and how do we deal with infatuation, being in love? I won't take time because to lay out a biblical theory of infatuation and a biblical theory of sexual intimacy, because we dealt with that in two or three or four lectures last fall. So if you weren't a part of that and are interested in exploring that in more detail, I'd recommend getting tapes or finding access to those lectures in some other way. Let me just briefly say that what I argued last fall is that infatuation is a organic consciousness-raising drug, God-given, God-supplied drug that expands our vision, expands our perspective such that it makes a very, very daunting and difficult reality of marriage interesting. It opens us up to that as an interesting possibility. Committing my life to something that I wouldn't otherwise, in my right mind, commit my life to. That's the short version of it. And sexual intimacy or sexuality is that sexual intimacy is a language that God has created, that is ingrained in us, that is built into us by God, whereby we can communicate to one another a commitment to one another between man and woman, a commitment that matches the commitment of marriage itself, as the Bible defines marriage. That sexuality, giving my body to another person, just simply means, in the God-given language of sexual intimacy, it simply means I am yours, I and I alone am yours, and I'm yours for good. So, again, that's a shorthand version of it, but that's the theory that's behind everything that we're going to be talking about tonight and throughout the quarter here. So what I want to speak to briefly, and I'll try to make my comments as brief as I can to give room for time for Larry and Nancy, but I want to deal first with the issue of infatuation, being in love, falling in love. What do you do when you are in love with someone? It's an incredibly compelling feeling. Incredibly compelling experience. How do we deal with it? And what do I mean by deal with it? Let me frame the question here. The assumption here is that I want to pursue righteous obedience to God. That's my underlying assumption. So if I want to pursue righteous obedience to God in every area of my life, how do I do that with respect to my sexuality and all that my sexuality entails? So how do I deal righteously and wisely with the sexual desires I have? How do I deal righteously and wisely with this being in love feeling that can come upon us? Let's talk about being in love first, dealing with infatuation. Seems to me that there's two mistakes that we can make with respect to love or infatuation. Remember, just so my language doesn't stumble you, I'm using the word infatuation the way the ancient world used the word eros, the way we use the word being in love or falling in love. We tend to use infatuation in a kind of condescending, dismissive kind of way. Infatuation is adolescent, infantile puppy love. That's not true love. True love is, but I'm talking about true love. That feeling that I love you, I will love you forever, and I feel like this feeling will never die, and this is the real thing. That feeling that feels like the real thing is what I'm talking about. Infatuation per se, romantic love per se, is inherently meaningful and substantial. That's the lie. That's the first way that we can go wrong, the first misperception that we can have. And it seems to me that three things follow from that as wrong actions or wrong approaches. First of all, it's wrong to act on infatuation apart from all other considerations. Let me underline that, apart from all other considerations. Sometimes I think when I'm speaking on this issue, I get misunderstood. I may very well be in love and act on it, and I am highly motivated to act on it, but there are other factors that are in play. Wisdom, the reality of the situation, my interpretation of the situation, all of that, I take a reading on that and I come to realize there may be an actual relationship happening here. Maybe this is the one that I'm going to give my life to. And would one act on that? Well, yeah. Eventually, one has to sort that out. The fact that I'm in love is no reason not to sort that out. I'll talk about that in a second. But I'm not acting on it because I'm in love. I'm acting on it for other reasons, because it seems like the wise, obedient, righteous, reasonable thing to do right now. That's why I'm acting. The mistake that we make is that love is a reason by itself. Love is meaningful and substantial enough that just feeling the way I feel is all the justification I need to write the note, write the letter, give the flowers, give the box of candies, you know, whatever. I've got to act on this because I'm in love. I would argue that that's wrong. To speak, to act out of love and only out of love is a mistake, it seems to me. One of the most meaningful times in my life, and this sounds really incredibly silly, but it was a very, very important learning experience for me, a real experience of growing in faith. When I was in love, let's see, it was before I became engaged to my now wife, I was feeling particularly insecure about the relationship for some reason. I had got some signals that I was having trouble interpreting. I thought she was interested in me, and then something happened. I don't even remember now what it was, but that kind of cast doubt on that, and I just didn't quite know where I stood. But more importantly, I realized my confusion was really more about what do I want, where am I going, what am I going to decide, than it was even about what she was thinking about me. I didn't know what I wanted. And I remember sitting for hours one night, reaching for the telephone, getting the number halfway dialed, and then finally hanging up and not making the phone call. But I really wrestled with, should I or should I not call her and talk to her on the telephone? And as I wrestled with that issue, it became clearer and clearer to me that the reason I was hesitating from calling is that it wouldn't, you know, what was she going to tell me? What I really wanted was that 1-800 hotline, psychic hotline, you know. What I wanted was the future to be known to me. And what an incredibly, what an incredibly cruel burden to lay on her. Jody, tell me the future. Tell me where this is going to end. Tell me how this is going to work out. Are we going to get married or are we not going to get married? Well, she doesn't know. She doesn't know any more than I do. But I was really wanting to simply deal with my lack of comfort, this agony that I was in, an agony born of the love that I was experiencing, my longing, my desire. And it was all I could do. I mean, I literally had to sit on my hands to keep myself from calling, to keep myself from acting on this. But something inside of me, I think a better part of me, was saying, that's not the loving thing to do. It's not the right thing to do. It may be what you want to do, but it's not the right thing to do. That's what I'm talking about. Just having other considerations, like what is wise, what is righteous, what is obedient, what is loving, what is kind, what is compassionate, dictate our actions rather than, but I'm in love, and let that justify anything that we might say or do. Second mistake I think we make is because it's inherently meaningful, is because we can have a tendency to feed it in order to try to keep it alive. We don't want it to die, and that it is the feeling. We don't want that feeling to die. When I was much younger, I had gone to a Christian camp and had met a young woman, and we had got to know one another and had talked at this Christian camp. I didn't really know her very well. She didn't know me very well. But we started corresponding over the summer. And I can remember, this was way before the technology that you guys have. I mean, all we had was LPs, vinyl LPs. I put this LP of Santana on, you know Santana. And let the music feed it. I mean, I kept that love alive all summer long by putting music on and imagining, dreaming, thinking about, and totally creating a fantasy of who this young woman was in my mind. When we finally got back in the same town at the end of the summer and we met, I mean, the infatuation was gone in a moment because she wasn't the woman I had been fantasizing about all summer long. She wasn't who I fell in love with. Well, that's my fault. You know, why didn't I just let it evaporate? Why didn't I just let it go away? Why didn't I let it just die? Well, I know why. It's a great feeling to feel in love. It's something that's desirable in its own right, and so I didn't want it to go away. But it's wrong, I think. It's something that we shouldn't do. I think I mentioned this last quarter. I know nothing about what Song of Solomon means, but there's one phrase in there that, if it means what I think it might mean, it's a great, great passage where the chorus throughout the Song of Solomon, the young woman is speaking to the daughters of Jerusalem and says, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, something or other, something or other, do not arouse or awaken love until it pleases. If I'm understanding what she's saying to them, she's saying, don't feed it. Don't make love happen. Let it happen to you, but don't make it happen. Then the third thing is that I think we can allow the fact that we're in love to become the lenses through which we interpret the actions of another person and engage in this incredibly misleading wishful thinking. Because I'm in love with them, what I want is for them to love me back. And so I can take the most innocent little gestures by them, the most innocent little kindness, the most innocent little act of compassion, where they're simply being kind, they are simply being friendly, they're simply being compassionate, but I read into it, they love me. They love me back. And I allow my being in love to be that distorting lens that misleads me in interpreting my relationships to, in particular, to the other person, the one I'm in love with. On the other side, that all those things are mistakes that are made because we make the mistake of thinking that infatuation is inherently meaningful and inherently substantial. It's also wrong, I think, to take the perspective that infatuation is inherently sinful. It's not. It's just an experience. It's just something that happens to human beings as human beings. It's neither righteous nor unrighteous in and of itself. It's just there. What follows from that, I think, two things can happen if we make the mistake of thinking that it's inherently sinful. One is that if anything like love enters my experience, then I have to cut off the relationship with the person. It's got to be dead. I'm falling in love. I can't go there. That would be wrong. I think sometimes people misunderstand my view of infatuation along those lines. That's not what I'm saying at all. Just because love is not a sufficient basis for pursuing a relationship, it's no reason not to pursue a relationship. That's wrong. And similarly, some people interpret me as saying that if you are in love, then you have to do everything you can to, I mean, don't ever act in any way that's based on that love. No, that's not what I'm saying. There may be other considerations that would make it wise and righteous and responsible of me to act, to communicate, to relate. So, to summarize that, it seems to me that falling in love happens. And it is neither right nor wrong, but it must not be what makes my decisions for me. It must only be what motivates me in making certain decisions. As a motivator, it's fine, and it's fulfilling its God-given role. But to be the arbiter of my actions, to determine what my actions will be, that's a mistake. It's not capable of doing that. What's the right way, then, to deal with infatuation of being in love? I think three things. Mostly, we will find that we need to suffer silently in unrequited love. Sounds awfully dramatic and poetic, but I think it's true. Some of the best times in my life in coming to terms as a creature in relationship to his creator is to have this agonizing longing for another person who had no interest in me whatsoever. But for that reason, I had something that I had to take up with my creator. I have never prayed more in my life than when the person I loved was not loving me back. And the suffering that it was entailed in that, the agony of that, learning to... I mean, it raised one of the single most important question of human existence. What are you going to do with a creator God who makes you want something that he doesn't give you? What are you going to do with the creator who allows you to have an unfulfilled longing? What are you going to do with a creator who makes you suffer? And coming to terms with that question is about the most important question that any human being can come to terms with. Okay, secondly, so we suffer silently in unrequited love. I need to decide my behavior on the basis of other criteria, not on the basis of my love, and I need to keep my objectivity. I need to understand, I need to have enough objectivity to know that eros, infatuation, has a distorting effect on my judgment and my perception and my desires. And in recognizing that, not allow myself to believe that reality is necessarily as I am seeing it, because I recognize I'm under the effects of infatuation. I think all of those things are the right way to handle it. Okay, let's shift over to sexual desire. Sexual desire, to believe that sexual desire is inherently sinful and inconsistent with holiness, I think is wrong. That's not true. But out of that false belief come, again, some wrong approaches to dealing with sexual desire. I have known people who have taken the perspective that because sexual desire is already sinful, and I have it, therefore it's too late for righteousness, I might as well indulge my sexual desires. That may sound awfully foolish, but I think more than one person has fallen to that logic. It's already too late. I'm already tainted. I'm already corrupted by sexual desire itself. What difference does it make whether I act on it? Sexual desire per se is not sinful. It's not already sinful. That's just simply not true. I fully expect that Jesus experienced sexual desire. Now, what I mean, and the reason I say that is not because I have any records that you don't have, but that because he was a human being, and he was not only a human being, but he was a human male, and I think I know a little bit about what it's like to experience existence as a human male. So, did he experience sexual desire? I expect so. Well, in what way was he righteous then? I can barely imagine this. I mean, all of us are in a position where we can barely imagine this, but in my imagination, I can imagine being attracted to, fascinated, drawn to a female in the way that males are, and then in the same moment have this judgment, this thought, this discernment come to bear that says, I'm not married to her. She's not available to me. and have that truth literally resolve the issue for him. Was there sexual attraction? Was there sexual desire in a sense? Well, sure. But was there sin? No. Because he always knew what to do with it. He could always put it in its proper perspective. He could always put it in its proper place. He always knew what context to put it in. That's not for me. That's not available to me. That would be wrong. That would be disobedient. And have that judgment about it resolve what he's going to do and how he's going to look at it and what attitude he's going to take toward it. Our problem as perverse creatures is that you can imagine us. Well, that wouldn't be obedient. Oh, yeah, so? I mean, that's not weighty enough for us. The innocence and the sinlessness and the righteousness of Jesus, I suspect, would have consisted in giving sufficient weight to goodness, godliness, and righteousness such that it resolved the issue for him. That doesn't happen that easily for me. Yes, I know I ought to value righteousness above all else, but do I? No. Not always. And so I'm conflicted in a way, I'm fragmented in a way that I don't think we would have seen in the psychology of Jesus. But it's important to recognize it's not that he had nothing to resolve. It's not that there was no attraction. It's not that there was no desire. It's not that there was no possibility of finding that interesting. I think as a human male, he found that as just as inherently interesting as any human male who's ever existed. But he knew what to do with it. And he knew how to respond to it. Because we have a tendency to make the mistake of seeing desire as inherently sinful, our tendency is to live in denial about our own humanity. We mask our sexuality with piety and pretend like I have no such desires. I'm righteous. I'm good. I'm a Christian. That's not a part of my life. That's not a part of my experience. Bull. So being somewhat self-aware, transparent, self-confessing, self-acknowledging about that, I think it's important as a right way to deal with sexual desire. Yeah, it's there. Sure. It's a part of my humanity. That's not the same as being shameless. I mean, there is something about masculine culture in this country. I don't know what it's like anymore, but I remember growing up in the 60s and 70s. You go into the locker room or you go into the workplace, into the factory, and hear men talking to one another. It always made me feel very, very, very uncomfortable. Because as much as I didn't know very much, one thing that was clear to me is they weren't talking about women the way my father treated my mother. Women were an object, a commodity, a thing, a toy. There wasn't the kind of respect there that seemed obviously their due, given the model that my father had given me. There's something about being transparent about the force of my sexual desires without finding my inability to control them shameful. That is not good, that's bad. That there's a shamelessness about that shouldn't be there. We need to be ashamed of our lack of self-control. We need to be ashamed that my passions rule me rather than me ruling my passions. So I'm not talking about that kind of shamelessness, but a kind of transparency that acknowledges I am what I am. And it's okay that I am a sexual being. There's nothing wrong with that. But I need to be a righteous sexual being rather than an unrighteous sexual being. And then finally, because we are inclined to think that sexual desires are wrong, we seek ways or techniques to stop having the desires themselves. You know, what can I do to not have any of these desires? Well, that's unrealistic, for one. Secondly, that's not holiness. We don't find holiness by purging ourselves of the desire. Holiness is not being desire-free. Holiness is being in control of myself in the face of desires. That's different. Sanctification is learning that even if I have such desires, as I describe Jesus, even though I have such desires, I'm finding the kind of commitments that allow me to put those desires in their appropriate context and resolve them, if you will, put them aside, lay them aside as irrelevant to me when they are irrelevant to me, when I cannot act on them, when they cannot be a part of my of what I fulfill. The other mistake we make about sexual desires is that any and every sexual desire is inherently natural and therefore good and can freely be satisfied. That's true, sexual desire is natural, but that does not mean that every manifestation of it is natural and good. It is created for a particular context, and only in that context is it right to act on. So what's the right way to deal with sexual desire? Ultimately, to practice self-control. A good old-fashioned, even pagan virtue, but one that we don't give enough thought to, I think, even as modern Christians. And it's certainly a Christian virtue as well. We need to practice self-control, always trumping sexual desire with my desire to be good, righteous, pure, noble, loving, compassionate, and so on. My desire to do the right thing is more important than my desire for self-gratification sexually. Now, the more important question, and I'll close with this, the more important question that most of us have is whether we're talking about infatuation or sexual desire, both of them are incredibly, incredibly compelling desires. It's all we can do to muster self-control and to not yield to them and to not act on them and to not want to fulfill them. I think it's important to see that there's a false perspective that we can get, that there are definable and doable steps that we can take that will empower us to overcome the compelling desires we can't otherwise control. I mean, if we find that we can't muster self-control, we run to the bookstore, help me, give me the book that gives me the 10 or 15 ways to manufacture self-control. We frame it in other words, but that's what we're looking for. What do I need to do to make me into a different person who can exercise self-control tomorrow because I can't seem to exercise self-control today? Tell me how to get there. Tell me what to be. You can make a lot of money writing those books because we desperately want the answer to those questions. Let me give you some possibilities here. If I were writing a book, I could write a book on four steps to controlling sexual desire. First step, don't allow yourself to dwell on your sexual desires. Try to distract yourself however you can. Good, helpful advice, yeah, but it doesn't get to the root of the problem, does it? Because of the root of the problem is, I want to allow myself to dwell on sexual desires, and I can't keep myself from wanting to allow myself to dwell on sexual desires. If I could do this, then I wouldn't be writing your book, right? It really hasn't answered the real root problem. It's only apparently. It's given an illusory answer to that. Secondly, watch what sexual stimuli you permit in your life. Don't look at pictures of naked women. Don't go to movies, whatever. Would that help? Yes, that would help. And if I really wanted to gain self-control sexually, I probably wouldn't do these things. But therein lies the problem. I want to do those things. Or I may want to do those things. I do want to feed those desires. Who's going to empower me to not want to do these? Who's going to empower me to do this step? Same thing with the third one. Watch what you talk about with a woman. Don't talk about things that are too intimate, especially intimate things about sex or relationships. Well, very good practical advice. But again, that's something I would naturally and logically do if I already practice self-control. But if I'm not practicing self-control, it's the very thing that my devious mind is going to gravitate toward. Watch the environment you put yourself in when you are with a woman. Don't take a walk under the moonlight. Yeah, I can do that, but I won't do that unless I have resolved a deeper issue. So where does the real power come from? where does the real empowerment to be a person of self-control come from? It seems to me that there's one and only one thing that can and will empower me to overcome any compelling desires, whether it's sexuality or eating or any other area of my life. It's an existential commitment, and I'll define that in a second, an existential commitment to goodness and righteousness that is stronger than my desire for sex or for love. And what I mean by an existential commitment is a commitment to have my individual, personal, human existence, my existence, defined by a certain set of values and defined by a certain kind of being that I want to be. We all have to come to a point in our life where we decide, I do indeed want my entire existence to be about obeying God. I want it to be about serving Him. I want it to be about being the kind of creature that He created me to be. And to make that the defining commitment of my life. If it's the defining commitment of my life, or to the extent that it's the defining commitment of my life, there's a certain empowerment that happens there, because that's more important to me than fulfilling any of my bodily desires. That is, if it's more important to me than fulfilling any of my bodily desires, then there's a certain power there that is the basis and foundation of self-control. It's when I have not decided that. It's when I'm wavering in that commitment. It's when I'm double-minded in that commitment. Yeah, that's all fine and good, but I don't know if I want to give up. I don't know if I want to give up love and sex enough to make it what my whole life is all about. Well, we don't really have an option as disciples of Jesus, I think, but to come to a point where that becomes the defining commitment of my heart. And in making that commitment, that's where, to the extent that we hold true to that commitment, we gain power to overcome all these other passions within us. The question that you're going to ask me, the question that I ask myself is, okay, that's great. How do you make that existential commitment? You know, what do I have to do to make that? That's a lonely choice that nobody can help you with. No book can help you with that. No other person can help you with that. No technique can help you with that. I don't know anything externally that can go to work on you to make you make that right decision. That's a lonely individual decision that only you can make. But it's a decision that we have to make if we're going to do this thing right, I think. So I'll shut up and let Larry and Nancy add some things to what we're saying, and then we're going to open it up for your questions and discussion.
I have a question. Help me understand something you were saying. You were talking about infatuation and using it as motivation rather than the arbitrator of our actions.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that a little bit more in terms of where my commitment to goodness? It seems to me that my commitment to goodness and righteousness is ought to be the motivator, like what you were just talking about, rather than necessarily infatuation. So that was a little confusing to me.
Okay. Well, I think the role that infatuation plays is I'm making a decision. When I make a decision to get married, I'm not making a decision that is inherently right or inherently wrong, inherently good or inherently evil. That is, there's nothing in the moral fabric of the universe that says Jack needs to marry Jody. The fact that I commit my life to a particular woman is not a moral issue. It's an issue. It's a personal. It is another existential issue, but it's not a moral issue. So, what's going to motivate me to commit my life to that particular woman? Well, being in love, I think, plays a big role in that. It motivates me to begin to explore the relationship and to find out who this woman is and to begin asking questions about her values and her relationship to truth.
So it kind of makes you kind of want to explore. It's kind of a...
Right. But it would be wrong for me if that being intrigued with her as a woman led me to get to know her a little better, and I found out that she was a very, very shallow, empty, and foolish woman who hated God, had nothing to do with God and righteousness and truth, but I was in love with her. if I were to go ahead and allow the fact that I'm in love with her to arbitrate, should I marry this woman? Well, yes, I'm in love with her. That's the height of folly, the height of foolishness. That's what I meant.
On that same subject, it seems to me that this is not just true for people who are single. Or infatuation isn't necessarily just an issue that's an issue for people single. It's also an issue for people who are married.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
It's kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
It's working with it in the same way.
Yeah, I don't think I talked about this.
The same principle applies in terms of it's not a good or bad thing. It just is, and it's what you work with it. It's like how Jesus probably responded to his own sexuality.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I remember my surprise the first time I encountered a woman having been married, where those feelings of just being intrigued with that woman came from. And sort of the mythology that I had absorbed that I hadn't even really critically analyzed was love is true love, and it's something that you experience for one and only one person forever, so you would never experience, you'd never even have any hint of that toward anybody else. Should never happen. Exactly.
And it's absolutely wrong because it happens.
Right. Yeah. And
or it means there's something wrong with my marriage.
Yeah. Or yeah.
I picked the wrong person.
Right. I hope you can hear them. Can you hear? In that regard, Margaret just handed me this. I didn't have time to digest it. Can you give us a summary of?
Could we get a mic for her?
They've, in the typical way of science, reducing everything to matter in motion, they've done some, I guess it was MRIs of people who are experiencing infatuation, and to look at the patterns, the brain patterns, and to try to figure out what's happening neurologically during that. And they've distinguished the pattern of infatuation is different from the pattern of sexual arousal. It's different from the pattern of simple happiness. It's its own unique little pattern. And apparently what's going on is your brain is just totally drunk on dopamine, which is a neurotransmitter, which it kind of intrigued me. I'm hoping in this series that you'll talk about the mind-body. You get the impression from this article that you feel kind of, as reading it, I felt kind of stupid for being infatuated because, after all, I'm just, in a drug-induced, hallucination or something like that. There's no basis for it in reality. I'm just being jerked around by my neurotransmitters and to a certain degree, I think that's true, and to a certain degree, I don't think it is true. And I'm hoping you'll get a chance to talk about when you run into a research like this that reduces us to matter in motion. How do I think about that, and specifically with infatuation?
Well, maybe later tonight. I don't want to interfere with their response now, but maybe I'll address that one.
I was just going to make a comment that I thought that your point about how we tend to try to mask our desires with piety is a really important piece of this, that being honest with ourselves and our desires and what happens. And I think it kind of speaks to the whole issue of how we respond to our emotions in general, and how we tend to think about emotions as right or wrong rather than information. And I think that's another case where we do that. We want to repress what we feel or pretend we don't feel it, rather than knowing what we feel and deciding what a wise response to that feeling is, or understanding it, trying to interpret it, make sense out of it, and then be deliberate about it.
I think what Nancy's talking about is really hard work, and it's probably part of why we don't do it very well. And that makes it easy to fall off the horse on either side, if either we deny it or we give into it and try to make it so. I mean, it's like those books that you're talking about. It's either books on how to have self-control or saying things in a different way that make them okay, make anything okay, so we can do anything and feel good about it. Because the alternative is to do the work that Nancy's talking about, and that's really hard and it's uncomfortable, and it's not something that we do very well, unlike Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jesus did it well, and maybe even quickly. And I think that that's part of our humanness, that we to learn how to struggle with that and know that that's what we're up against is a really vital and vital part of that existential commitment we make to being wise people and to following God.
I think one of the reasons we have, probably a lot of different reasons, but one of the reasons we have trouble that makes Jesus different from us is that he didn't have any problem with what the conclusion was going to be.
Exactly.
That is, the conclusion is, I am only a creature, I am only a servant of my Creator, and that was okay with him. And our mind is working overtime. I mean, we realize, whoops, if I go down the way my thinking is leading me, I'm going to come to a position where I'm not calling the shots. I'm not the center here. I'm not what this is all about. We don't like that idea. So we begin very early on this process of rationalization where we tell ourselves stories and lies.
Yeah. Because we want what we want.
And often the way that manifests itself is in what we call this is difficult or a difficult issue or it's complicated or something like that. Well, it's not really all that complicated. We complicated it.
Yeah.
But we excuse it because, well, it's really not that straightforward to know what I should do here.
Yeah. It's that question that you raised of what am I going to do with a God who doesn't give me what I want?
Yeah. Exactly.
Because that's the fear. I mean, that's what we're up against. In ourselves. Yeah. So, want to open it up for questions?
Okay, sure. Okay. Question?
Just a quick one. one of the things I've noticed when I used to be the infatuation queen, and I think, you know, every week, whether I needed it or not, and fortunately, as I get older, it's like only every other week or something like that, so it's not so bad. But one of the things I've noticed, being very experienced in this particular effect, is there's this lie in my brain. It's not merely, you know, I have this desire and God's not going to fulfill it, but the lie along with it is, if I can't have this, I can't be happy. I can't be content. I must have this or life is meaningless. And do you suppose Jesus experienced that lie? Or is it something that the moment it appeared in his head, he said, oh, that's ridiculous. Of course not.
Yeah, I of course I'm speculating. You know, I mean, but
the last temptation, Jack.
What?
The last temptation.
The
last temptation.
No. I think he means the actual last
temptation. Matthew 4. I mean, he was offered anything, everything.
Okay. Yeah, I see what you're. Yeah. So did that strike him in such a way, you're saying that you think it's likely that struck him in such a way that it would have registered with him, yes, therein lies my happiness? I mean, if not, it wouldn't have been a temptation.
Well, that's what the lie was.
Right.
Therein lies my fulfillment, my destiny. Am I going to trust God for not getting it?
Right. Now, I wonder if infatuation is not different than that temptation in this respect, and that is, I can't be happy without it unless I have this thing. I mean, could I have a feeling that I can't be happy without this thing, and he really did have the feeling, and resolving the issue of what he's going to do wouldn't necessarily resolve the feeling, wouldn't necessarily eliminate the feeling, but it would resolve his action, what he's going to do about it, and even how he's going to think about it, and that he could think about it. Well, that's silly. Not that I feel that, but it would be silly to conclude that feeling is actually representing reality to me, because it's not. It's only a feeling. That's how I would tend to frame it.
That would be different then. Yes.
At the end of your talk, you were talking about making that existential choice, and that will help resolve some of the issues. And I, I'm wondering if this is what you meant. I don't think, though, that there is a final choice to be made and then it's once and all done with.
No. Yeah, thank you. No, I'm not saying that. I have never come to that level of finality because I think that's what it means to grow in sanctification, is growing in the depth of my commitment to these things. It can be real and be substantial, but yet not be strong enough or deep enough for me to be unwavering in it. And I don't think there's any believer who's so strong and so unwavering in it that they're totally empowered to have self-control in every respect all the time.
So at the core of my being, I am committed, but at any given moment, the temptation could be pretty significant that I give into it. And
right.
And hopefully, if that is the core, I am struggling with it too.
So I guess what I'm saying is that, okay, so we fail. We're weak of will. What do we do with that? It seems the important thing to do with that is to revisit the question, is to allow that weakness and that failure to bring me back to revisiting the question. How do I want to define my existence? Do I want my existence to be defined by my passions? Or do I want my existence to be defined by my commitment to obeying my Creator? And I think we can use our failure to really learn and become more sanctified and become deeper in our faith if we revisit the question and ratify my commitment to it. Otherwise, we're just spinning our wheels.
I don't really know if it's a question, but in how you're talking about that existential decision that you make, I can't help but equate it with, in modern Christianity, you make that decision to follow Christ and then all of a sudden everything's okay and you don't struggle with those temptations anymore. And I'm wondering if there is a way to, when you're making that existential commitment, to equate that with the feeling rather than, you can have the logical decision that, okay, this is the wise choice and I'm going to make that choice because I've made this commitment to righteousness and truth. But I don't feel that way. How do you connect those two? Or is that ever possible? Or is that something that you're just continuously overcoming, is the feeling? Because I know in modern Christianity, that's what was so attractive to me, is the feeling. You feel like, oh, God helps me overcome this, so I feel better. And I don't feel as drawn to the temptation. But I'm finding in my everyday life of making that existential commitment, God doesn't make the feeling go away. There's no happy magic pill that makes me feel good. And I'm trying to put those together with what I was raised in Christianity and what now I'm coming to believe about Christianity. And I'm just wondering if there's anything I'm missing in the middle there that would connect the two with the feeling and the commitment.
That's a really good question. I think that that you're right, there's no magic pill. I do think that there's something about clarifying the commitment again and again, and I do think it takes doing it again and again in that sense. So I don't think that our current Christianity is accurate about that, and I think that's really unfortunate, because I do think we're kind of led to believe that once we make this commitment to Christ, there's two parts of it. One is that then if we struggle, then all of a sudden we're not living according to the Spirit, or we're not empowered, or we're doing something wrong, that we're having this struggle. And I think that's one place where that's not true. I think it's more about that this is what life is like, and this life here is not what's going to ultimately fulfill me or make me happy. That said, I think there is some real satisfaction that comes out of a track record of deciding what's true and what I want to pursue, and actually being more and more connected with reality, that this life isn't going to give me everything I ever wanted, and that the loss of that, the longing for that, is going to be something I'm going to bump up against at every different stage of my life. And this life has a lot to offer. If I don't have to make it give me everything, it can give me a lot. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So if I can wait, if I can keep my eyes set on where real life is going to be, where I'm going to get the final fulfillment of things, then I don't have to put the pressure on this life to give that to me in quite the same way. And so I do think that there's a satisfaction that can grow as we kind of get that more and more over the course of our lives. But at the same time, I think that the information of knowing, I think that's why it's so important that we know when we're disappointed, when we're struggling, when we're that's not what this life is offering. And it takes us back to that very question over and over of, am I going to trust this God that I'm now finding out is who he is? Does that make sense?
I think there's another piece to what Nancy was saying, and I think that there's this presupposition or this sort of a priori thing that's taught and communicated in our culture, and particularly, in the Christian culture, and that is somehow we're supposed to be successful. It's kind of what you were getting at. Somehow we're supposed to be able to get it right, or we get the right rule out of the Bible or the right principle, or somehow we're supposed to be able to do it right. And I was just looking at the parable of the Good Samaritan and how this lawyer comes to Jesus, and he's got this same attitude of, I'm right. I'm going to use you, Jesus, to show that I'm right, and I'm going to expose you as a fraud who's wrong, who's really not from God. And so you can see how it really affects how he interacts with Jesus, how he looks at the scriptures. And I think that I don't think it's the point. I don't think that it's a lie that we're supposed to get it right or that we're supposed to be successful across the board. I think the point is there's this process that God has, this existential process that God has us in, of that he works in our hearts, and we want what's good. We value righteousness, or we want to want it. And we fall flat on our faces, and then we experience the pain and suffering of failure, and we want it. And it's that, I think, and out of that comes faith. And that's the miracle, I think, is that rather than being successful, is that through all that process, we want it, and we keep on wanting it. And that's the miracle. Not that we get it. It's not about getting it right or doing it right. It's that we even want it, and it changes how we see what we see, how we think, and how we relate to people, how we think about ourselves, and it's very much. It's very different than what we are led to believe it ought to look like. Does that make sense?
If God created us so emotionally driven, why do you think it is that he doesn't give us that emotion for him or for... I mean, it's not inbred in us to pursue righteousness and truth. You have to come to that conclusion and decide to do that and then go against all your God-given emotions often to pursue those things of righteousness and truth. What do you think his purpose is in that, in not... I mean, obviously, it shouldn't be easy, but it seems odd that a God who created such an emotional person and being would not at least mold them into having those emotions drawn to him at some point. But it doesn't seem like that's the case. It seems like it's always a choice. It's always a...
But I... It's always a... Is it true, I think this is partly what was behind what Nancy was saying, our emotions are drawn to God, but I think what you're saying is not without being mediated by my choices. I mean,
it doesn't
come easily.
Right.
But it is the case that my faith, my relationship to God certainly has an emotional component to it. I learn to love him. And I think that love has an emotional component to it. But it is learned. That's true. And that's what's so strange, is that it has to be learned rather than something that just is spontaneous.
It's this really strange experience of coming to appreciate and love God through having suffered, having experienced the consequences of your own sin. And that's...
Right. I think what I struggle with is that it's, for me anyway, it's always a logical thing. I can very logically understand why it is I love God. I just can't equate it with an emotion. And that's frustrating as a human who's drawn emotionally. You want to feel that love instead of just appreciating it and understanding it and being thankful for it and even experiencing it. You still don't feel it.
I would say that was true for me for a really, really long time. The feeling of it that came wasn't something that I chose, but one day I found it. It was like a gift put on my lap, and I wanted it. And that was for me probably a week after I found out I had cancer. And my doctor said, there's no cure for this, and if it's gone to this place, then you're going to die. So... do I want a God who is not only going to just not fulfill my life? My daughter at that time was 1 year old, and I thought, how can a God not let my daughter have a mom? You know, wow, that's awful. And then I found that I loved God. In the worst of circumstances, losing my life and maybe her losing her mother. That was an emotion that was given to me and not a choice. And that, I think, is the most... I don't know if God gives that to every believer. I think that was like the best gift of my whole life. And I was talking yesterday, in fact, to somebody who experienced something similar, thought that their child was probably dead, and came and said, what a gift, because at that point, I found out that I wanted God in a way that my church experience has never led me to want. I haven't even wanted God, and now all of a sudden, in tears, she's telling me, I want God because God gave me this gift. That's an incredible gift.
So there's hope. You just have to have that experience.
I think so. I don't know that it would come apart from that. I don't think so.
But wouldn't you agree, it's God you wanted, not the experience of wanting God? I mean, you're not spending the rest of your life trying to recreate the intensity of the emotion that you probably experienced at one point. That's not the pursuit of your life. The pursuit of your life is God, I would assume. Right?
If I understand your distinction, yes. He gave me this want that was really deep.
Right.
Probably bigger than any emotion I know. It was...
Right.
It was like... I've described it to you before. It's like I opened up a new dimension, and now I don't only live here. I also live in heaven. It's like I opened up a new door, and that's where I live also. And it's like I have my foot in two places, eternity and here. Because it's like I got to die... So I understand life, and that's a very cool thing.
Yeah,
very cool thing.
That I don't know how to articulate this, but what Christine has just said about it was almost deeper than emotion, I think, is important, because what I find too often is in kind of modern Christendom, it's surface emotions that we go after that are merely emotions. They don't go deep in the way that Christine is describing. And if they do go deep, then to what extent and how they manifest themselves as surface emotions is almost immaterial. I mean, it's going to be what it's going to be when it's going to be that way. And sometimes it'll be, you know, a really wonderful gift at an emotional level. Other times, I may not feel it in the same way. but the reality remains the same. I mean, there's this substantial underlying reality that has changed my entire existence. And it's that change in my existence that we really want, not feeling like my existence has been changed. The thing that drives me crazy, because I have seen too much and know too much, is when a worship leader stands up before a church and tries to be sentimental toward God and lead me toward sentimentality toward God, because I know it's not real. I mean, it's not spontaneous. It's not coming out of some reality. It's coming out of some presupposition or some assumption or some cultural expectation that love of God is going to manifest itself like this. Well, sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. And it's suffering, it's life, it's circumstances, it's the realities of life that reveal what's going on, what's real and what isn't real. But there will be an emotional component to that. There's no question about that.
Can I say more?
Sure.
I think we're speaking right to what you were talking about at Reformation Fellowship on Sunday when John said, I'm telling you these things to make your joy complete. Because it's this kind of joy beyond joy, this yeah. understanding of what's real that he was speaking of, which is, let me tell you about life. Yeah. Let me give you an account of what's gooder than good. Hope you guys can take this in because this is what it's going to be about. And that's the existential choice that you were talking about. But I would go beyond that, if I could, to say it's an existential gift that ultimately I'm given. Apart from choice, it's given to me in an incredible way. But then after that, I have to keep choosing time after time to react to a particular emotional draw or passion, even though I've been given that. I still have to. It sounded like you were saying I have to make one choice, and I think what Larry was speaking to and Nancy, and I'm sure underneath you, what you were saying is it's not just a choice to keep pursuing righteousness and goodness. It keeps on going and going. Do I want this under these circumstances now?
Right.
And having given that gift, I don't see myself saying no to that question ultimately ever. I don't think it's going to happen.
Right.
That's how I know I'm a believer.
Good.
Summer ultimately asked my question, but I have a new one, and that is, if you have in your head made the decision that, yes, I want to live in obedience to God, then is it an indication that you're not a Christian if your emotions carry you away and you don't have the self-control to actually stop and make a decision? Or you have emotions that just kind of bubble up and make you make the wrong decision?
Are you talking about on a particular occasion?
Yeah.
I don't think it's easy to answer that question. The way, for those of you who come to Reformation Fellowship in the last chapter of 1 John, he's going to make a distinction between what he calls a sin unto death. He says there is a sin that is not unto death, but there is a sin that is unto death. It depends on whether the choice that I'm making is a defining choice of my existence. That is, I'm choosing against defining my life by obedience to God. If on an occasion I make a choice that is a defining choice to choose not to define my existence by obedience to God, then yes, it means I'm not a believer. But we can experience weakness of will where we make a disobedient choice, but it's not really grounded in a decision to choose against God. It's just weakness of will and shows that my faith is not whole, it's not grounded, it's not complete, it's not unwavering. I need to grow. I have a long way to go.
And certainly my emotions can affect that
yeah.
process.
I just wanted to make a comment about kind of this idea of, and see maybe if Jack agrees with this, about when we make an existential commitment to God many times through our life and aren't able to fulfill it, it seems that even when we fall, there's another gift that comes, and it's the virtue of humility, the gift of humility, in that in falling, it's sort of a way by which we can come to understand who we are in relation to God, that we aren't perfect, we aren't what we strive to be, not perfect, but, I mean, virtuous people. And so even though we fail, it's like there's a hidden gift given. And I would almost say, reflecting on my own life's experience, that the gift of humility is one of those things that there's a lot of virtues that we can get through life by striving and repeatedly working on them through life. But humility is almost one of those things that we get as a result of striving and failing and bearing the scars and the pains of that and always continuing to make the choice to have God as the defining center of our life. That's all I was going to say.
Just trying to put together, Summer, what you were asking and what this gentleman just said. Some of my most profound experiences of God have been exactly at the times when I have failed, and he has so choreographed reality that I realized that he still loved me. There was a time when I was really struggling and not being very successful, and being pretty convinced that God found me as disgusting as I found myself, and in the midst of a situation where anybody looking at the situation, it would be very obvious that I had failed. And it was a warm night, a window was open, and there was a bus stop nearby, and a man got off the bus. I heard the bus arrive. Man got off the bus and walked under the window whistling a familiar tune. And I was actually pretty much of a baby Christian at that point. Was going to a church, Peninsula Bible Church, down in the San Francisco Bay Area, which is where I met Jack and everybody. And the tune sounded, my mind started, you know, what is that song? What is that song? And it turns out that it was a chorus of a song that the Jews for Jesus had just sung at PBC that was from Isaiah 12:2, that when I started singing the chorus was just a lie, 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 you know, just a meaningless syllable. But when I got to the words, my brain was following this. The song was, "Behold, God is my salvation. I will trust and will not be afraid. For the Lord God is my strength and my song. He also has become my salvation." And what a strange universe God had put together, so that here, when I'm right there thinking, God must surely hate me, I am disgusting, how could he possibly love me, that he would place somebody who knew that song, probably the percentage of people in San Francisco who knew that song, he put them on that bus, and he just happened to be whistling the chorus to that, just as I'm laying there thinking, you know, I am so disgusting. There's no way God could love me. You know, I'm lost, and there's no hope for me. And God saying, "Behold, God is my salvation. I will trust and will not be afraid." It's like God walking into the room and seeing the evidence of my failure and saying, "I love you. You know that I love you." So, failure, I mean, I can't claim to have the humility that he was talking about. But, you know, maybe that'll come later down the road. But there have been plenty of instances where I have thought, you know, there's no way I can be good enough for God. And he's saying, "You don't have to be good enough for me. I still love you."
Anything else? Maybe I'll address the earlier question that Margaret asked about the mind and the brain. From my perspective, the relationship between the human mind and the human brain is the most complex philosophical problem that there is. I mean, I don't know anyone who has adequately addressed it. It seems to me that you have to assume that the biblical perspective assumes what philosophers call dualism, that there is an important distinction between the mind and the body, between the mind and the brain. That the in academic circles, the most popular view is what's called behaviorism. It's the view that anything that I experience in the of the mind, a fear, a belief, a desire, an inclination, anything, is nothing more than simply a certain pattern of firing synapses in the brain. That's all it is. And they call when we talk about I want to do this, or I believe this, or I fear that, or I think that, that's what they call folk psychology. And that's just an old-fashioned, antiquated belief that those have any reality to them. What we really know, those of us who really know what's going on, is that you have this biochemical organ that fires, and it fires synapses in certain order, and that runs the universe. That determines everything that is. Well, it seems to me clearly to be the case that you can't believe in a biblical worldview and accept that solution, that position on the relationship between the mind and the brain. The mind is something other than material. The mind is something other than just this organ. Is there a relationship between the organ and the mind? Well, yeah, some sort of relationship. But defining exactly what that is incredibly complex and out of my reach, certainly. And I think certainly out of reach of human knowledge today, and probably will always be out of reach. I wouldn't be afraid to predict, because I think it's just so complex. One of the things that I think is a sort of empirical evidence that there's a difference is that you have stroke victims and people who have brain damage who will describe themselves as trapped. They seem to be aware of more than they can be aware of, if you understand what I'm saying. That is, their brain does not allow them to perceive, judge, think, and do those mental activities up to the level that the mind recognizes it should be able to do. Well, if that's the case, if you can be aware of your own limitations in that way, then how can a damaged machine be aware of its own damage? I mean, that isn't there some transcendent perspective outside of the human mind that is aware of its own condition somehow? And that's a kind of empirical evidence, it seems to me, that the mind is other than and different than and transcends the brain on the one hand. On the other hand, there's just the common sense realization. We all recognize that a belief is a belief. It is not just a pattern of if it is, Francis Schaeffer used to argue this. He, you know, it's incredible to think that a French intellectual on the left side of the Seine, is that how he put it? On the left bank of the Seine, who is writing this poem to his lover and telling his lover how much he loves her, really believes that there is no such thing as love, that all we have is firing synapses. We don't really believe that. As intellectuals, we may spout that as a theory, but none of us live that way, and none of us can live that way, and none of us ever will live that way. We all recognize that all these things, human phenomena, psychological, emotional, and intellectual phenomena, have a substance to them and a reality to them that transcends just matter and energy. They clearly have more substance to them than that. So, and that was your intuition behind your question is, something seems funky when all is said and done, they're describing love as nothing more than a certain proportion of chemicals in the brain. That's right. It's more than that. Does it have a foundation in that? Yeah, there's some relationship between what's happening in the brain and this reality, but the reality is not reducible to its physical and material basis. It's not reducible to that. It's only correlated with it. It's only related to it somehow. And exactly what it is that is correlated to it, that's the mystery. But it is interesting in that regard. You know, what they say there does then tend to bear out my analysis based on a whole different sort of experience and a whole different kind of analysis, that there's something drug-like about it. There's something drug-like about this state. And I think that's true.
I don't know if you're going to be dealing with this later on in the series, and if so, that's fine. I had a question about the title of this particular lecture was, you know, being chased in Sodom or something like that. Is how to, if you don't happen, well, how to respond to the culture. I had an interesting experience yesterday, I guess it was, when a friend of mine sent me a parody on The Lord of the Rings, which actually took part of The Lord of the Rings and kind of chopped it up and added new characters, actors and actresses. And it was, let us say, it was crude. But I found it funny as hell. And the person, when I got this thing, I sent it to two of my colleagues who, it turns out, had already seen it and had not forwarded it to me. And when they said, "Oh yeah, we already saw this," and I said, "You saw it, but you didn't send it to me," and they kind of looked at each other like, "Well, we didn't know how you would have." They both know I'm a Christian; they're not Christians. We didn't know how we'd deal with this. And I said, "Well, why?" And you could see that there was part of them that, if they were being honest, across their forehead in big glowing letters was, "Because we think you're a prude." And but actually, one of them, after struggling for an explanation, said, "Because we thought you had better taste than that." And I said, "No, you didn't think that. You thought I was a prude. You thought I'd go." And they said, "No, no." Methinks they protesteth too much. So at any rate, as I'm thinking about it, I'm thinking, I don't like to be thought of as a prude. I don't like that. On the other hand, I don't know exactly why I don't like that, and maybe I should be a prude, and maybe it was wrong for me to find this funny. I was trying to think, why, objectively, this thing, it's definitely crude. It was not, I didn't find it titillating. I'm not sure if a guy would have found it titillating. It's just funny. It did not reflect good values about how people ought to behave. But on the other hand, the people who were behaving in a way that was not good were objects of ridicule. So it's not like that it was endorsing bad stuff. So I was just wondering, what do you think about that, those issues of, let's say you've got a terribly hysterical but crude joke that... is that something we should never? Should we never tell unseemly jokes? Should we not laugh at them? Should I resist looking at this thing and laughing and saying that's funny? Is that reflect a problem that I have that I should resist?
Well, we do need to part throughout the quarter. We'll probably talk about this a little bit more, about the distinction between Christian and biblical sexual values and Victorian values. Those are really different. And most of, I'm not sure how to define prudery, but most, if my picture of what it's like to be a prude comes out of being a Victorian, not out of having a biblical worldview. I mean, if you remember, the Victorians had long tablecloths to cover up the certain part of the furniture that bent out, that they called the knee of the leg of the furniture, because it was immodest somehow. I mean, they really were extreme, and they really, just the very fact, it was almost really an ethic of denying sexuality, of trying to not even acknowledge that it existed. So any words, any language, any shapes, anything that would remind us that we are sexual beings was somehow taboo and to be eliminated. Well, that's not the biblical worldview. In fact, the Bible can be downright earthy at times. I mean, read Song of Solomon. It's in the Bible. Oh, don't read it. I don't understand it. I don't know what it's there, but it's in a way very graphic. It's a kind of an erotic love poem, at least at one level. So the biblical worldview is not afraid of acknowledging the reality of our physicality and our sexuality, that's real. On the other hand, the biblical worldview sees sexuality as a kind of sacred act, and by sacred I don't mean of or pertaining to God, but a really having a very special, specific, unique role in human existence. So it's not mundane. I mean, we're not dogs who mate with whomever we want to mate on the street whenever we want to. And anything that kind of reduces our sexuality to something more animal-like and mundane doesn't really understand our sexuality. Now, that doesn't exactly answer your question, because what if we're ridiculing that? Well, then that becomes more complicated, because sometimes what we laugh at in jokes and in comedy is not even really the subject matter. What we're laughing at is the cleverness of it. It's the cleverness that just tickles us. And so it really doesn't really make any difference what the subject matter would have been. It's just so clever, what the irony that they've... And in the end, I finally decided if I find something funny, it's because it's funny. And I'm not going to worry about the subject matter. I'm not going to worry about whether or not it crosses some boundary of propriety, because I don't think it's the subject matter that's really making it funny anyway. So I basically don't worry about it. But I will say that there are times when I find things very unfunny, and what I find very unfunny and lacking in humor is when they have done nothing more than reduce sexuality to an animal function. I don't find that funny. I just find that disgusting or boring or out of touch with reality. But sometimes you have those going together.
Hey, Jack. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, too, if sort of on a cultural level, if part of why Margaret's coworkers didn't respond to her the way they did was because, as a culture, Christian culture, we've done such a poor job dealing with that ourselves. And it's like it's hard for them to imagine that there might even be good reasons why we see sexuality the way we see it, or there might be, I mean, actually good reasons, rather than just we're prudes. So they don't have any way of understanding or way of knowing what's behind it. So they just make an assumption, because in some ways it's a rather safe assumption, because we've done such a bad job.
Well, I would even go so far as to say, in my own experience, I spent much of my Christian life as a prude, as a Victorian. I mean, I really had absorbed those values, and they really were true. I mean, that's what made me respond the way I responded.
Right.
So we as a Christian culture, I think there are a whole lot more Christians like me than who have a really biblical worldview.
Right.
So we have done a lot to communicate to our co-workers in our culture that we don't think sexuality is something that we should try to pretend doesn't exist.
Yeah, it's like the process of falling off the horse in denial is we don't even have a way of talking about it or thinking about it at all. And so people are left with we are snobs or we are prudes.
I guess I'd like to make a case or make a plea for seeing degrading material for what it is and recognizing the inappropriateness of it to be interesting, I guess, to a person who's defined their life by wanting what God wants and being committed to righteousness and so on. I mean, I'm thinking of whatever is pure and upright and you know, think on these things. And I work with some very earthy people, and it's interesting.
What's he called?
Pardon?
What'd you call them?
Earthy, very, you know, very worldly, very titillated by crude humor and so on. And it's interesting to me that I find themselves sharing humor among themselves that they don't share with me, because I think they recognize that I don't want to enjoy that kind of humor. I don't, you know, it's not that I'm this holy, righteous, you know, pure person. And it's not as though I wouldn't find certain humor funny if I were exposed to it. But I don't want to be the kind of person that is fascinated by that and or seeks it or comes across as having an interest in it, I guess, because that's inconsistent with the choices that I've made about what's important and what's valuable and what I want my life to be all about. So there's a funny balance there, I guess, is what I'm saying.
No, I agree. I really am not attracted to the coarse, earthy stuff. I don't like lots of Shakespeare stuff for that reason, even though I love Shakespeare and his worldview, that when it gets coarse like that, it doesn't interest me. And it may be because I have so much Victorian in me, that may be part of it, or it may be because we're committed to different things. I don't know. I can't say. But I